We present My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is Antonia Fraser.
Thank you very much. Our teams today are Dennis Powell and Frank Muir against Irene Thomas and Dennis Norden. First, a round to probe their vocabulary. Can you tell me, Frank, or hazard a guess at, the meaning of the following word? A baldric.
B-A-L-D-R-I-C.
Yes.
Oh, isn't it the sort of thing that Elton John is wearing at the moment? On his recent tour of personal appearances. It's kind of bandolier. So it's the sort of thing that the Red Shadow might have worn. It's like a Miss England sash, Miss World, and instead of Miss World, it's got cartridges.
It is. Brilliant, as ever, 2 marks. Irene, to proselytize.
Proselytize? Oh dear. Is that when you convert somebody from one religion to another?
Spot on.
Oh, good.
2 marks?
Luck.
Dillis, fustian.
Fustian is a word which is really, I think, means some kind of cloth, but is used to suggest rather worn out and tedious performances.
Absolutely. And 2 marks. There is a bonus mark if anybody knows its derivation. It's so strange.
It's sort of cloth, is it?
It's
shoddy.
But if you know where the cloth came from, Irene?
There's that veiled theatrical song, isn't it? Fustian means cloth. Whether fustian means it's connected with the...
Well, actually, apparently it comes from a suburb in Cairo called Fustat.
Get away.
But I think Frank gets a half for beginning to sing and then stopping. Dennis, a rebus.
Rebus. Yes, they're... It used to be very popular in Victorian times, and I think they're sort of being revived a little now. It's a form of making sort of visual puns with the letters of words or with words themselves. I went to a pier where I collected those. I'm just trying. One was A B E 3 D. A B E 3 D, which is three in a bed.
Oh.
Or there's S-Y-M-P-H-O-N.
Unfinished Symphony.
The Unfinished Symphony.
But it's got to be pictures.
But it's got to be pictures, Dennis.
Yes, I thought it was.
It's got to be drawings.
Has it got to be one of those children's things where they do the back? I thought a rebus was any kind of sort of sleight of hand with letters and words. I mean, yeah, they have those children's books where they... They tell a whole story and they draw a cat and they have a C crossed out and the word's supposed to be at.
That's it. Well, I dare say it can mean both. But I think mainly it means pictures. I used to sign myself with an ant for Antonia as a child in people's autograph books, should they ask me, which they mainly didn't. I think it's mainly pictures, but I don't see why it shouldn't also be words. So get your marks.
I think it should be any... Did you used to put any written in any lines as well when you autographed your friend's books? Mm-hmm. Did you used to quote, you know, by hook or by crook, I'll be first in your book and things like that.
I was always too slow for that.
I used to put, Jill's boy was tall and slender, my boy was quite thick-set. Jill's boy wore silk pyjamas, my boy wore flannelette. Jill's boy was wild and woolly. My boy was pure and good. Do you think I'd change my boy for Jules? You're damn well right, I would.
Before we go into round two, here, Frank and Dennis, are the quotations you were given for the last round. Frank, yours is I Left My Heart in San Francisco. And yours, Dennis, is The Biggest Aspidistra in the World. A round of origins and derivations. What was the origin of the following word or phrase? Or from what did it derive? Frank, mad as a hatter.
Oh, yes, yes. This is... We all know this, don't we? It's the fact that hatters were supposed to act in an irrational manner in the sort of 18th century backwards due to the fact they used some kind of mercury compound in preparing the felt for the hats. That's what we've all been told, and there's no reason to... And it was popularised, I think, firstly by Lewis Carroll. No.
You are doubtless right. You're certainly right about the derivation. It does. It comes from the millinery trade. Well done. Irene, the lion's share.
Ooh. Well, the only thing I can think of is that the lion, being a big and ferocious beast, always killed something and ate the best part of it. And then the jackals and vultures moved in afterwards, so he got the best part. And the other animals and birds got the rest, which wasn't quite as good.
You're along the right lines. Can you think of where this saying might have come from? That might help you.
Mm. Aesop fable?
Absolutely, Aesop.
Thanks to Dennis here.
Well, I don't know the fable. I don't know the punchline of the fable.
Well, I think I'll give you one mark for Aesop. Actually, what happened in the fable, the lion joined all the other beasts in a hunt and claimed one quarter of the spoil as his, another quarter for his superior courage, another quarter for his dam and cubs, who were clearly a greedy lot. And as for the remainder, he said, "Let him who will dispute it with me."
What's
the sensible
animal?
Did you say sensible or selfish?
Well, it comes to the same thing in fables.
Dillis, paraphernalia. Can you give me the origin?
It's a Latin word. And it means something to do with what was left to the wife. It's the part legally belonging to a wife in ancient Roman times.
Well, you're quite right about its meaning. It is the possessions allowed to the widow. When you said Latin, you meant Greek, didn't you?
Did I?
Yes.
Yes.
You always mean Greek. You
yes,
are a resident
yes,
Greek.
Yes,
I was stunned to hear you say Latin. It does, in fact, come from the Greek ferna, a dower. As you were well aware.
Sounds like something you take for a sore throat. We've got some paraphernalia.
Given to you by Parry Gorick, the Welsh chemist.
Dennis, a thug.
Well, I associate this with the kind of novels that written by people like John Masters or earlier in my youth, E. Phillips Oppenheim, where there was a kind of Indian assassins who were called thagi, who had a religion or followed some kind of principle called thagi, and somewhere in there comes dacoits, and there were always Lascar seamen. Well, no, that was pearl trading for copra.
Yeah, the Lascar seamen play dacoits.
That's very good. But they were all part of a mysterious East that haunted your boys' comics and so on that you've got only a slight handle on at that time.
So far, so good or so bad. Could you just remind us all what you would do if you happened to be practicing thuggy?
I think you'd kill somebody. It's the thing that you come up behind them with a sort of silk scarf. Don't do it on your sister. This is what I got into trouble for, yeah.
Well, you're quite right. Originally, these people were members of an Indian fraternity, and the reason they did this very unpleasant thing was to propitiate their god Kali.
Right, Kali, yes. Mm. They used to do an incantation to Kali before. It was the incantation that gave you time to struggle out of the rope, you see.
Around a first come, first served. Which of you four can first tell me what it is about the following Victorian quatrain that is literally odd or abnormal. A jovial swain may rack his brain and tax his fancy's might to quiz in vain, for 'tis most plain that what I say is right.
What's odd about it?
A jovial swain may rack his brain and tax his fancy's might to quiz in vain, for 'tis most plain that what I say is right. It can't be said to have been written with great ease, that I agree.
It's rubbish, isn't it?
Oh,
I mean,
as
a message, it doesn't sing, does it?
So what's literally odd about it?
So there's something geometric inside it, isn't it? I mean, it's not that it's sense, because it's senseless. So it must be something funny about it. It's
one of those literary exercises of some kind.
322 letters. It's
yeah.
the only poem.
The comma's in the wrong
letters.
Place or something like that. Can you chop the lines up and make something different?
There are different ways. Frank and Dennis are nearer.
It's one of those...
It's not exactly having 322 letters in it. You want to think more of what might be missing.
It's
always J.
It doesn't contain the letter Z. Or it does contain the letter Z. Or is there any poem written
in
1850?
I'll repeat my clue. It can scarcely be said to have been written with ease.
Ah, there's no E in it.
Yeah.
Dennis.
What's a good clue, yes, yes.
Do you realise, Antonio, that there's been six of us wasted 4 minutes of our lives failing to answer that question.
Never waste time answering that sort of question.
Next, a team round of impromptu interpolations. Frank and Dillis together. Can you give me, in 30 seconds, and Leonid, the loveliest scorer in the Western Hemisphere, will keep the score, half a dozen nouns that would appear in a dictionary between the words bargain and barnacle?
Bark has dog, a bark has tree, and bark has boat.
You're losing time without gaining marks.
Balm, as in floats on top of beer when it's fermenting. Barley corn. Yes, it's a noun. Don't shake your head. Look it up in the book. How much were it? Four.
All right, I allow barley corn.
Barge.
Leonie now says we must stop this foolery, and I am going to allow barley corn. Even I've got a heart.
Thank you.
How many did they get then? 2.5.
Out of how many? 50.
Dennis and Irene, similarly, can you give me in 30 seconds half a dozen nouns that would appear between monastery and monk? Half a mark each.
Money.
Yes.
Money box. Money lender.
Yes.
Money bark.
Mongoose. There's a lady out there. There's a ticket.
Yes.
By golly, it'll be a free one for you next week. Mongrel. Dog.
Stop. You've done extremely well because you've got 3 marks.
It's money did it. Money will do it every...
A round of unusual Christian names. Can you tell me the surname of the literary character whose Christian name is as follows, and also who created him or her? Frank, Zuleika.
Dobson, Max Beerbohm.
2 marks, jolly good. Irene, Godolphin.
Oh, it's out of Dickens, isn't it?
No.
I think somebody's surname is Godolphin. Can't think of anybody's Christian name. Isn't it Pooter? No. Don't know then.
Dennis?
No. Cannot offer.
Dennis? Godolphin Horn was nobly born. He held the human race in scorn.
Is it Hilaire Belloc?
Hilaire Belloc. Yeah. Oh. Dillis, Wackford.
Wackford? Oh.
Yes.
Oh, that's Dickens. That's the schoolmaster.
Yes, his surname?
What's his surname?
Tis Dickens.
Squeers.
Quite right. Wackford Squeers, horrible, well-named schoolmaster in Dickens. Dennis. Tinkleberry.
Tinkleberry Thrush, who's the hero of a novel called Always Is Not Forever by Prunella Slyke.
Very good.
No, all right.
You had me very worried.
Yes, I did, didn't I?
I was gazing at my sheet and wondering if literature was dead.
Well, the whole art of these panel games is finding different ways of saying I don't know.
Who's to deny that there is a novel with that name?
No, it was actually Beechcomber.
Oh,
you
really?
Like Beechcomber? Yeah. Tinkleberry Snap Driver.
I mean, you can't go through Beechcomber's funny name.
Yeah.
Tinkleberry Snapdriver by Beechcomber.
Otherwise. Like Walter Scott pseudonym.
And now we come to the last round and Frank and Dennis's quotations. Frank, your quotation is Tony Bennett's famous song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
Well, I was asked by a lady journalist with red hair and hands said, you sing on my music, have you many instruments at home? I mean, do you play and things? And I answered much in the same fashion as Beau Brummell answered. He was a vegetarian, and somebody asked him if he was a keen vegetarian, and he said, I once ate a pea. Well, in the same sense as what musical instruments have you at home, I said, I once had a traditional Scottish folk harp, and it was given to me 6 years ago in a small but moving ceremony at St. Andrews University when I was elected rector by the students. And afterwards, the first sort of public occasion for the rector is to be the guest of honour at an evening out, a kind of dinner dance given by a club there called the Kate Kennedy Club, which the whole object of the exercise is to get the newly elected rector drunk. You see, and which I, it was no problem to me. And we it was a dinner jacket thing, and we started off with drinks at the master of the college in his rooms, and we had a few drams, you know. And then we all went on, and were received by the vice-chancellor, and we had a few more drams there. And he said, he drew me aside and said, you realise, Rector, the whole idea is to get you tiddly. I said, yes, so I hear, but I don't think really there's much chance of that, Chief Chancellor. And I was feeling a bit warm at the time, and I couldn't take my jacket off, so I rolled my trousers up to above the knee, and had a few more drams. And then we went on to the dinner dance, which was nearby in the little village of Anstruther, and we all piled into the coach, and they stopped me driving, which I suddenly felt I wanted to drive, but they stopped me, and we went on because the great friend of the university there has a disco called the Wigaloo or something. And he every time we have one of these three yearly things of getting the new rector drunk, he gives the disco over for the evening to these to his friends, the students. And we went along there, and it was terribly nice, and we had a few more drams. And I said to the president of the Kate Kennedy Society, I said, really, the way you keep socking in with the drams, you should really call this the dram sock. And I laughed. I was the only one who laughed. I think I laughed, I think it was round about 22 minutes. I thought it was a very funny joke. And I sort of went on laughing, and they sat me down. And then... And then they made a little presentation, and he said, Rector, as this is your first function, we are going to give you a traditional Scottish folk harp, which was quite small, much smaller than I thought a harp should be. It was sort of oval, with a flat bit at the bottom, and was about, I suppose, 2 foot by 18 inches. And it had a big hole, oval hole, in the middle. And I said, it's got no strings. A normal triangular harp, as you run your strings over, it goes... He said, ah, yes, but the old Scottish folk harp, you see, as you draw your fingers over the strings, it goes... I suppose it would. And I said, Marvellous having a party at a disco, all the coloured lights flashing on and off. He said they haven't been switched on yet. And I then heard his plaintive Scottish voice shouting, "I've lost my loo seat." And I said, "Are you sure this is a harp? Because I can hear your friend, the owner, saying, 'I've lost my.'" He said, no, he lost his lawsuit. And suddenly the evening was over. And I woke very late the next morning, about 5:15 in the evening. And I wasn't feeling at all well. I think the smokies didn't agree with me. And in fact, when I got home, back to London, I was still a bit white and shaky, but I found I hadn't got the harp anymore, somehow, during the evening it had gone. So when people say, "What about musical instruments? Do you have any at home?" I say, "I once had a Scotch traditional harp." And they say, "What happened to it?" And I say, "I left my harp in some friend's disco."
Now let's see how you get on, Dennis, with another song, the comic song made popular by Gracie Fields, the biggest aspidistra in the world.
Well, something I must admit to you, because as we agreed, there's to be no secrets between us. But the fact is, I don't really enjoy going to the theatre. Now, I take no pride in confessing that, particularly in view of the strong links our Madam Chairman has with modern drama, but the truth is, my attitude towards it could be summed up by an old New Yorker cartoon. I always remember it showed two men coming out from seeing a highly esteemed Broadway hit, and one of them is saying to the other, "And for that I miss dessert." Now, I must emphasize that where I'm concerned, that attitude's only partially prompted by the things that get put on these days. It's really much more to do with the fact that my very presence in a theatre seems to have the same effect on the actors that evening that Moby Dick had on sailors. I only have to turn up at the place, and things that are all right every other night suddenly take a turn for the disastrous. For that reason, I bet I'm one of the few people whose theatre-going memories include the only known performance of Peter Pan where Tinkerbell made a crash landing in row C. The Tom Jones concert where he crossed his legs too fast and immobilized himself for 3 days. And a memorable production of Giselle in which Nureyev leapt so high he caught his foot in the loop of a rising curtain, a fate that was known ever after among ballotomanes as hoist with his own leotard. Mind you, but performances of Shakespeare seem to have been where my presence has wreaked the most havoc. How well I remember seeing in the National one evening, watching the changing expressions on the face of Romeo as he slowly became aware that the balcony was about to fall on him. Nor shall I quickly forget a performance of Hamlet one night at the beautiful open-air theatre in Regent's Park, particularly the moment when Horatio failed to make an entrance from behind a bush because he'd just been mugged. But you may ask, if that was the effect I had upon Shakespearean productions, why then did I even consider booking a ticket for the RSC's recent distinguished production of Antony and Cleopatra? Well, it was simply because I happened to have more than a nodding acquaintance with a leading member of the cast. It was the asp that Cleopatra shoves down her bosom in the last act. The company had got it from a neighbour of mine, a chap they call a herpetologist, who actually trains snakes for all kinds of stage, screen and television shows. And what I'd found irresistible was the way he'd gone about preparing this one for its Shakespearean debut. Because, you see, after taking the precaution of removing its venom, what he'd done, you see, was he spent months training the asp in what he called bosom recognition. In other words, he taught that snake that any time it was deposited inside human clothing, it was only to open its mouth and take a simulated bite if it found itself on an area of flesh that was all rounded and soft. Well, as I've indicated, I shouldn't, in all fairness, even have attended that first night. Not that I hold myself totally to blame for what happened. I think the company were at least partly at fault for giving the part of Cleopatra to an actress who happened to be, I've got to say it, flat-chested. Because that had the obvious consequence that when she dropped the snake into position, because there wasn't any rounded and soft flesh near that area, he just kept going till he found some. and that, as you probably guessed, was on an area of flesh that only came into public view when Cleopatra turned round. All right, it was a distressing moment for the actress concerned, but even had it been totally my fault, that still wouldn't have made it the global catastrophe it was reported as the following week in the next issue of the stage newspaper. Because you know what headline they put above the story? The biggest asp disaster in the world.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see from the score sheet that Frank and Dillis are the winners in this week's contest over Dennis and Irene. Goodbye.
In My Word, the chairman was Antonia Fraser. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shryan and Pete Atkin.